The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon. How are you? 5 on 5, 5 on Ray at RTE.ie. I was just thinking, watching the news last night, should they give our politicians Fitbits and see who wins on the number of steps between now and the 8th of February? Isn't it odd the way things have happened? The way the news agenda is setting the agenda for what's discussed in the lead up to the general election. I was reading a piece in one of the English papers today, and it's in The Guardian, and the headline is Amsterdam's first female mayor shrugs off abuse as she tries to tame red light district. And I thought, this is interesting. Her name is Femke Halsema, and she's the first female mayor of Amsterdam. And so they would be like the London mayor. They would have real power. And I think they're elected. So this lady has real power and she's trying to change things. And she's a woman. And as well as, concentrating on the red light district of Amsterdam and trying to change things there, she's also looking at the situation with drugs in Amsterdam. And they, like most modern cities, indeed most modern countries, have a problem with cocaine. They have a problem with cocaine in Amsterdam. And it says here in this article by Daniel Buffy, it says, she includes plans to work with companies in the hope of opening the eyes of the middle classes to the consequences of their cocaine use. And this is the quote from her. They should know or realise that the young boy who comes and brings their pizza and their cocaine is in danger of getting into a drug environment that is very dangerous to him, that could get him killed. Now, they're scary words. And I've said this before in the programme, and there are people listening now who will go out and do cocaine at the weekend. There are people who are listening now who know people go out and do cocaine at the weekend, and that's part of what they do, recreational drugs. But how many of those people make the connection between what they're doing of a weekend in the name of recreation to crime and horrific deaths and gang murders and all the hardship that surrounds all that? Do they make that connection? Are the same people who are horrified, some of the same people who are horrified at what we're reading about in the papers today and hearing on the news, are they making the connection between their behaviour, if they're using coke on a regular basis, and what's happening? I don't think they are. There's a disconnect. There's a real disconnect between their actions in the loo of a nightclub on a Saturday night and what goes on in Drogheda or Dublin or Limerick or Cork or wherever in gang warfare. And that has to be sorted out. People have to get real about that sort of thing, don't they? They definitely have to get real about that. I'm interested in that lady now, Femke Halsema, when she says things like that. I saw a thing over the weekend which was very scary. And it's allegedly a video of a party somewhere in this country, a Christmas party, and allegedly there was loads of cocaine at it, and the images were just hedonistic. Like, there was nudity and all sorts of things, and that's happening all over the country every weekend, and that's fueling the type of crime we're seeing regularly on the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock news and reading about in the papers. There seems to be this disconnect between that world and the other world. And we need to get real on that, and we need to make the connection. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know, like, yes, if everybody stopped doing cocaine in the morning, it would definitely, change things. But that's not going to happen. That ain't going to happen. So what is the answer? I honestly don't know the answer, but we need to be real about these things and say it as it is, I think. So she's the first female mayor of Amsterdam. And I see that Pope Francis yesterday named the first woman to hold a high-ranking post in the Secretariat of State in the Vatican. She's a laywoman, Francesca Di Giovanni. She's 66, and she'll assume a newly created post in a division known as the Section for Relations with States. So it's sort of their foreign affairs in the Vatican. So she's one of two deputy foreign ministers. So that's good news, isn't it? That's good news. But there needs to be women priests, and you know, priests need to be able to get married. And there's an ongoing, isn't there, spat between the current pope and the last pope about that, whether priests should be allowed to marry. It's a no-brainer, I think. Here's an interesting one as well for you. You might have missed this, because that's what happens in the lead-up to an election. As some other stories get lost in the melee, don't they? But the days of putting a child's name down on a school waiting list as soon as they're born are over. Now, I'd say this happens a lot more in Dublin than other parts of the country. But it was a conversation that you'd regularly have over the years in the playground, when you'd have you up there with your two-year-old or your three-year-old, and there'd be another parent there with a two-year-old and a three-year-old, and they'd say, have you got their name down for anywhere? Have you got their name down for anywhere? And literally, that's what people are doing. They were putting their children's names down the day they were born for schools in Dublin. Such was the demand for certain schools. Anyway, new school admission rules will set October the 1st in the year prior to admissions as the earliest date for formally accepting applications. So you now have to wait till your child is 3 or 4 before you can put the name down. They're allowing 5 years, a 5-year period, transition period. So the people who put the names down when their kids were just born, that works through the system. But as in from 5 years on, it'll be the 1st of October, the year before. And other new rules, it's going to cap at 25% the number of children or grandchildren of past pupils who may be admitted to a school in a given year. And the new measures are effective for pupils entering schools in the 2021-22 year and beyond. So they're saying here in this article by Catherine Donnelly, who's the education editor in The Independent, the ban on waiting lists will benefit families who move into a new area and who previously may have found themselves out of the running for getting children into a local school of their choice. So that's that there. What else have we got? We were saying that we're hitting the road this year, and because the general election is on, we won't be hitting the road until after that's over. Resources, don't you know? And all of the outside broadcast units will be used for election coverage, which is fair enough. So after the 8th of February, we'll be taken to the road. And we said we were doing this. So we've got loads of emails already. Una has been on to us. She wants us to go to Balbriggan and be guests of her writers group. Thanks for that invitation, Una. Siobhan Cronin was on. She wants us to go to Beddystown in County Meath to meet a group of sea swimmers. The ICA in Castletown in County Leash, they've asked us down for a cup of tea. Thank you for that. Noel from Meadenderry wrote us an email. He said, listen to you most days on my postal run. We'd love you to visit my hometown of Edenderry, County Offaly. It's beautiful. It has a beautiful square, has been upgraded, and the old courthouse has been transformed into an e-hive space for tired commuters to work in a fabulous space with all mod cons. An e-hive. I've heard of hubs, but I haven't heard of e-hives. As you may know, Edenderry got the unwanted award of the top town in Ireland with the most empty business units. However, we are fighting back, and two major derelicts are to be transformed, including the old Tesco site, which will be knocked and cleared, giving a total of 33-acre site right on our main street. When cleared, the first building will be a new library and community centre, stroke theatre. Exciting. I would be delighted if you would include Edenderry in your list of towns for your programme. And like our country, we have been on a downer, but we are certainly on the way back. That's the people of Edenderry. Thanks very much for that. So keep those coming in, and we're building up a file, and we're planning routes around the country. So we hope to do it once or twice a week, where we'll visit places around the country after the 8th of February. So keep them coming in to ray@rte.ie. Mary was on to us, Mary Byrne, and she says, could you please wish Josh Byrne from Carrick and Shannon a happy 8th birthday just after 3 o'clock. He'll be in the car on the way home from school. Love from Mammy, Daddy and Sophie. We don't usually do that sort of thing, but there you go. Happy birthday, Josh. Have a great day. And Maeve has been on to ray@rte.ie. Was busy. Maeve says, I sat down to watch Operation Transformation last night, and just before it started, I switched stations and saw the beginning of Taboo on TG Carr, which was about the families who use the Bumblance ambulance service for very sick children. We spoke to Tony and Mary Heffernan the other day, who set up Bumblance. Anyway, Ray, I never saw Operation Transformation in the end as it was absolutely riveting, the Bumblins programme. To say these families are incredible would be an understatement. The patience, kindness, love and wonderful spirit of these parents is mind-blowing. The tears were streaming down my face looking at the challenges that these families face. But lucky for them, each one of the children is so cute and their personalities really showed. Through the hard work of their parents, of course. It should be compulsory viewing for every parent in the country, if only to make us grateful for what we have. The drivers were amazing, and the rapport they have with the kids is wonderful to see. What a brilliant service, and long may it continue. And please pass on my best wishes to all of them, and well done, TG Cahir, on that. She says PS at the end. Sorry. Saw Operation Transformation on the Plus One service. So there you go. There you go, RT Plus One. And that was great. And we'll be talking to Tanya later on to see how she's getting on, giving up her Coca-Cola. That's Coca-Cola as opposed to just Coke. Now, perhaps our politicians this election should be saying the same, Ray. Our politicians have their head in the sand relating to drugs and big drug dealers, says Anna Kilkenny. And rather than prosecute the drug pusher, how about prosecuting the drug user? And I mean really prosecuting them. No slap on the wrist. Sort of zero tolerance, Alex. Wasn't it Giuliano who introduced that into New York? Seemed to work for them for a while. And you're wrong, wrong, wrong. Coke users know perfectly well the consequences of their actions. They just do not care. It's not a disconnect, just indifference. Aha. The answer to our drug gang problem might be simple. If tomorrow we could go and buy our hash, coke and heroin at our local pharmacy, what would the downside be? I don't think there'd be any increase in users or usage. Sean, I have to disagree with you there, Sean. I think for some of us, and for some people, the fact that drugs are illegal is a deterrent, that people don't want to be on the wrong side of the law. That's for some of us. And that if they were legalised, then that deterrent wouldn't exist anymore. And there's varying different results from around the world where they've tried to legalise or decriminalise drugs. And, you know, it's a big debate, Sean. We should have it. It's a big debate. Now, 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Coleman Nochter is with us after 4 o'clock. And Coleman is a psychotherapist specialising in child and adolescent behaviour. And he gives very sound advice on parenting and adolescence and problems with your children. And if you want his advice today, please Ray at RTE.ie. That's Ray at RTE.ie. I thought something nice just to relax you on this Thursday afternoon. So a little instrumental from Colin McNamara, Late Afternoon on Radio 1. Ah, that's lovely. Late Afternoon from Colin McNamara. That's just maybe nice and relaxed. I don't know about you. 51551 RayRT.ie. Jane says, going after the user is a dead-end street. Legalise, regulate and tax is the only way. Well, I don't know. It's the only way. It's in your opinion, it is a way. That's Jane. And Fiona says, well, ask the question, how much detail is too much for our teens about that poor 17-year-old who lost his life recently and was dismembered? I feel like walking my teens into a funeral home and pointing out the consequences of taking stroke, getting involved with drugs. Should we scare the bejesus out of them? Well, I'll put that question to Coleman Nochter when he's in after 4 o'clock. No better way to get through the school pickup than listen to Colin McNamara. Pure unadulterated bliss, says Maven Ennis. And that track was effing brilliant, says Ken. I don't think enough people know about Colin McNamara. He's a genius and he's on our doorstep. He used to play fiddle stroke violin with the Frames and still does. I think they're doing a gig this year, aren't they? But he has one, two, three, is it three solo albums now? I think three, at least three. And he's done soundtracks as well. And we've had him on the show a number of times. And he's just pure genius. He's brilliant. He is effing brilliant, Ken. 51551 Ray at RTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for your texts on this Thursday afternoon. Breda says that music is fantastic. Colin McNamara is the man. And Caroline says, Colin McNamara is the Enya of the fiddle, a truly awesome talent. And that musician, Colin McNamara, can you correctly spell his name, please, and advise him an easier to spell name would add to his bottom line profitability as an artist? Thank you, says John. You could be right, Sean, especially with Spotify and all those things. If you don't put it in right, you get no results. I would say, Colm, you can manage that, John, can't you? C-O-L-M, and then Mock, M-A-C, then new word, C-O-N, and then new word, I-O-M-A-I-R-E. And put it into Spotify there, and your life will change for the better. It'll be embellished in a big way. Yeah, more on drugs there. When you go into a men's toilet around Dublin, there are regular queues for the cubicles, yet no one is at the urinals. I don't think it's down to irritable bowel syndrome. We used to have a drink driving culture in Ireland, but new laws and implementing them has made this taboo. We need to do something similar with so-called recreational drugs. Maybe stop normalising them by calling them recreational drugs for a start, says that person. Well, I won't call them that anymore. Illegal drugs, illicit drugs. What would you like me to call them? Anyway, yesterday, excuse me, we were chatting about the posters going up on lampposts and everywhere around the country in the run-up to the general election. And one man who got in touch with us was Seamus Maguire. Seamus emailed in to tell us about posterfree.ie, which is a campaign to register your interest to make your area poster free. Seamus is on the line from Donegal. Good afternoon, Seamus.
Good afternoon, Ray, and thanks for having me on.
No, thank you for being on. Posterfree.ie, is it a new organisation?
No, I suppose posterfree.ie started last year around the local elections, and we got inundated at that time in terms of tidy towns and local community groups who came on board with us. We created an online map, and we had over 160 towns and villages who signed up at that time, who went out to candidates and advocated and asked them not to put up single-use plastic posters as part of the elections. I was a candidate myself. I ran myself, but I ran on a ballot of not putting up single-use plastic or using single-use plastic. So,
and when these people around the country, over 100 towns and villages, approached the candidates, what reaction did they get?
Well, they've actually done it again, Ray, for the general election, and a lot of tidy towns have sent letters out to the candidates, asking them not to poster in a specific area. Well, we achieved it. A lot of towns and villages at the local elections actually achieved their goals in terms of there were not posters put up within a town area, and we had it here in Donegal Town ourselves, and we're holding for the general election. So it was quite positive. Now we have over 220 towns and villages. It's really, I suppose, ramped up for the general elections. And on the main, most candidates will respect it. And if they don't, they're being asked very kindly by the tidy towns and the local community groups.
But of course, if one person, one candidate doesn't respect it, then they have an unfair advantage over the others, would they?
Yeah, what was actually happening on the ground, Ray, was that they were being asked, and maybe through social media, to kindly take down their posters. And I suppose, what a peer pressure, whatever you call it, they were going out and having to take them down.
They took them down. Okay, so it's
very
working.
Positive.
Yeah. So posters, you know a good bit about them. So are the majority made out of single-use plastic?
Yeah, all single-use plastic, basically made from oil, from fossil fuel. What you'll hear time and time again is that some politicians, they reuse posters. Some of them recycle them. The reality is that that's greenwash. They can downcycle them certainly into lesser products, but eventually they will end up in landfill, or they'll be incinerated. If they end up in landfill, it takes 400 years for them to degrade.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we're on a coastal town here, Donegal Town. 99% of what we take out of the ocean every year when we do our cleanups with Donegal Bay Rowing Club is plastic, and that's single-use plastic. So it's either ending up in our mammals and animals and fish, or it's ending up on the shoreline.
So definitely not kind to our planet. I was looking that up there because I had a vague memory that a lot of the presidential candidates didn't use posters. 4 out of 6 didn't use posters.
Yeah, and I mean, we have the youth movement in terms of climate change.
Yeah.
We have Greta Thunberg, who hasn't used posters. And I mean, we have the Extinction Rebellion people as well. I mean, when they go out, they have their cardboard. They have written on their cardboard. I mean, a totally accessible, totally recyclable way to do it.
Yeah.
And it just takes a bit of outside-the-box thinking. I mean, myself, I used reverse graffiti where I washed with water my message into the pavement. So I cleaned my message into the pavement. I mean, it doesn't take much, Ray. I did 5 minutes of research before I came on to you. There is a very large, one of the largest print companies in Dublin or in Europe, They're in North Dublin. They have a totally ecological board that you can buy off the shelf now.
Have you any idea how many posters will be out there for the general election?
Well, I'll give you the stats that we did for the locals, which is very similar, right? So there was over 2,000 candidates for 949 seats in the locals.
Yeah, more. There was more candidates, of course, than the general election.
Yeah, there was more candidates. There was 2,000 for 949. We reckon that was about 600,000 posters.
Okay.
That's a spend of 3 million, Ray. When you talk about all the issues we have in Ireland, what could you do with 3 million?
Okay. What do they do in other countries, Seamus?
I suppose the model I most prefer myself is the Canadian model, where they don't have posters, but what they do is they create a booklet of all the candidates and they send it out to all the homes in the area.
So each constituency would have a separate booklet, would it?
Each constituency would have a separate booklet that they send out with information on each candidate. That comes in your door. You either read it or not, or you recycle it.
Right, okay. And I have a vague memory of some place where they have this sort of centralised board where they can post an A4 size poster.
Yeah. So France would do that, where they have a centralised board where there's information on the candidates. Again, totally reducing the amount of plastic that's in use. I mean, the big issue here is we have a climate and biodiversity emergency last year, and only 2 days ago, The Guardian there published an article saying that the ocean temperature has never been as warm on record.
We've the hottest decade on record. Yeah.
The hottest decade on record. I mean, climate change is a reality. Mm. Our youth are leading the way in this, unfortunately, and they've done it without plastic posters. And I mean, look at what they've achieved in terms.
And what about the cable ties then? On top of that.
Huge issue, and that's a big issue for the tidy towns that we're constantly in contact with, that they're always left, and it's a huge issue, and they will only go to landfill as well, so, and they're discarded. You know, we find a lot of that washing up on the shoreline as well, a lot of the cable ties, and unfortunately the plastic posters.
I should make it clear that you're not running this time.
No, I have no affiliation, I'm not running.
Great. It seems that the amount of discussion around this gets greater and greater in each election. It looks like the days of the posters for elections are numbered to me.
Yeah, well, we definitely thought, we got huge traction at the locals, and we definitely thought that it was definitely coming to an end. Any survey that's done, Ray, over 90% of people say they don't want it.
Well, so, I'm looking here at Clareburn Live poll got 77% of respondents said that they thought the use of posters during election campaigns should be banned. Yeah,
yeah, and so you're left with the question, well, who is it serving? Who are these posters serving? All you get is an image, maybe, and a party name on the top, but you're getting no information from this. If you really don't know who you're going to vote for, you're going to go on, you're going to search, you're going to do a bit of research. So, and most of these posters, ironically, when candidates say or politicians say they're reusing posters, 5 years later they look nothing like the image on the poster, I might say, for a lot of them.
Wait till we see what they're saying here. Owen says, Ferns County Wexford was poster-free last time and will be poster-free this time.
Yeah.
And then Claire and Tralee says, as a pedestrian, I find the plastic tags left from posters to be most dangerous. They are at eye level and can do a lot of damage if one walks into them. They should be removed. Not kind to mankind, never mind the planet, says Claire. And an anagram of single-use cable ties and poster is citable. Ugliness transposed. I don't know what that means. Citable ugliness transposed. Or whether that is applied to the candidates too is just as much as an individual's choice as their vote. And can you get compostable posters for elections? Somebody asks.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just saying.
That's the place in North Dublin, yeah, that you were mentioning there, yeah.
But I was in the car yesterday, Ray, and my 8-year-old was in the back, and we came to a junction, and she said, Daddy, is that not very unsafe, that poster there? And, I mean, there are road safety guidelines in terms of posters as well. There's a whole issue around health and safety and around road safety.
Well, we read out the rules yesterday that were featured in the journal, and if you spot any breaking of rules when it comes to posters, you can report it to your local council, and they can take them down. You cannot take them down yourself. Isn't that the thing, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm asking this out loud, and I'll find out before the end of the programme. I presume that the Green Party aren't using posters, or if they are, they must be biodegradable.
No, unfortunately, most of the parties and candidates are using posters, and they're all using plastic. But as I say, it wouldn't have taken much. That product is available at the moment, so there's kind of no excuse.
Okay.
But really, With 97% of us with smartphones, we really need to get away from this archaic method of
election. But how long ago, Seamus, were we told it was going to be a paper-free office? How long ago was that prediction made?
Yes, but at least we can recycle the paper, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The M50 northbound is chockers. I don't know if that's with relation to posters or traffic. I think it's probably traffic with the tractors. And as a voter, the posters have absolutely no effect on my choice. Yeah. I'm sure I'm not the only one, says May. So posterfree.ie if you want to register your town or village to be poster-free in the lead up to this year's general election. Seamus Maguire, thank you very much.
Ray, thanks. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Two very lucky people join me in studio today, Karen McDonald and Michael Byrne. Both of them are lung cancer survivors. You're very welcome. Thanks for coming in. More than 2,700 Irish people every year receive the devastating news of a lung cancer diagnosis. And while lung cancer remains the biggest cancer killer in Ireland, early diagnosis and medical advances can be critical in ensuring patients gain precious extra time. Making Moments Matter is an important campaign from the Mary Keating Foundation, which hopes to highlight just how significant extra time is in the lives of patients and survivors of lung cancer. So it's early diagnosis. And in our Cork studio, we have Dr. Dervla Collins, Consultant Medical Oncologist at Cork University Hospital. How are you doing, Dervla?
Hi, Ray.
You can hear us.
I can, loud
and clear. Okay. I'm going to talk to Karen and Michael first, and then we'll come to you at the end, if that's okay.
No problem.
Great. Thank you. Now, Karen, what age are you?
I am now 54.
54. Michael, what age are you?
66.
66, right. Now, lung cancer, when you say it to people, they immediately associate it with smoking. Yeah. And in your case, Michael, there was a link.
It's hard to give a definite answer on it, but I think there was a link, personally myself.
How long did you smoke for?
Oh, God, I was smoking, we'll say, since I was about 16, 15, 16.
Were you a big smoker?
At times. I'd smoke, we'll say, in the end, actually, I used to go on a thing called Roll Your Own, and up to that, I was smoking at an average of about 40 major a day.
Right.
I went on to Roll Your Owns because it takes a lot longer to roll them and get them in your mouth. Sick what I spare down on a bit.
But they don't have a filter. That's the
only thing. No, they don't have any filter.
Yeah,
no. You know.
And eventually you gave them up.
3 years previous to the diagnosis, I decided I'd pack them in.
And in a way, that saved your life. Explain that to me.
I'll be honest with you. I packed them in and I was happy about it and the whole lot. I lost a brother of mine in 2013 to an identical twin, Sean. He had a brain tumour. And I thought that was a bad hurt and this, that and the other. So my family actually asked me to go and get an MRI on account of me identical twin getting the brain tumour, which I did, and everything was all clear. And the funny thing about it then, three years later, I got a light wheezing on my chest. I'm a bit of a musician, I do a bit of playing at the time and singing and all this, and it was annoying, very annoying. And I said, look, I better get cough bottles and stuff like that, which didn't work at all, so my good wife, Catherine, told me to go into the doctor and get it checked in case there was something gone down on me chest or whatever, you know.
An infection of some sort, yeah.
So I went in anyway and he put me on an antibiotic. And I'd say within the space of about 3 days, 4 days, I was thought I was clearing stuff off my chest. And I said, thank God that the antibiotic is working. But when I looked in the tissue, there were spatters of blood.
Right.
So that was a kind of a red rag to a bull sort of a thing. So I went straight back to the doctor. I didn't want to say too much to the family. I went back to the doctor. I told the wife, okay. And she said, go in, you might have, with the coughing and that, you might have tore something in the larynx or something. So he sent me straight there at Water Regional Hospital and they done tests, they done an x-ray and they came back and told me that I had a lung infection, which I was a bit pleased about.
Yeah. At the time,
that it could be something they can do, something, you know.
Yeah.
So they put me on two more courses of antibiotics, one this week and a different one the following week. And then I was to go back for another x-ray. But I actually knew, Ray, at the end of the other two that the wheezing was still there.
Yeah, there was something more serious.
So that was out of three courses of antibiotics and there was still nothing going on there, you know. So they decided then I'd have to go back. They see this as a killer in a way. They send you back to your own doctor then and they'll forward different information back to your own doctor and you'd have to wait again to see what's going to be happening, this, that and the other. So they decided then that I'd have to get the camera down to have a look.
Yeah.
So I got to see a lung specialist and she sent me in and she said to me, there's no other way of actually telling you. She said, Mr. Byrne, she said, there's a tumour there, she said, on the lung, on the right lung. It's about the size of a 2 euro coin. So I won't say I didn't get a fright or anything like that, but I was half expecting something of that nature. But maybe they'd be able to tell me it was benign or whatever, you know.
And did she use the word cancer?
Oh, she didn't know. She
just said tumour.
Tumour.
Right.
So I took it for granted then that when she put it that way, it was probably cancerous, you know.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, I didn't even ask her, to be quite honest. I got such a fright.
Yeah, of course.
I came out anyway and back to the family and that. And I was after asking her, I said, what's the story as regards to, like, go anywhere from here? But she said, we'll send you to James's in Dublin, she said, and she said, we'll have a PET scan done. She said, and I said, what's the process there? Well, she said, we want to find out if the cancer after going beyond the lung. If it is, she said, there won't be any operation. If it's not, she said, we'll be able to go in and take the tumour and maybe part of the lung. They won't know that, she said, until we do further tests and all that. So I went to Dublin anyway, and I will say they were brilliant in James's and them place. They were fantastic. They done the test, and the hardest point of a lot of this is the waiting in between.
Of course.
Wondering, is it there or is it here or there? But
sleepless nights, I'd imagine.
Oh, my God. And just turn temperamental on the head and everything. You
got very anxious about it.
Yeah. So I
suppose you're confronted with your mortality, aren't you?
Well, I mean, people often ask me what was the first thing came to your head. When you say cancer, it's death.
Yeah.
That's the first.
Now, that's not the case anymore, but for your generation.
No, and a lot of people think this even to now. They do think that. But I think the whole thing of cancer and cancer in general is, I don't know why everybody should have a general check over.
Should, yeah.
At least once a year, at the least.
Mm.
Immaterial. You might see some little, small little things going on in your body that there might be only a hiccup. Now, I remember, actually, to the diagnosis, I remember a couple of times, we'll say within 2 years or so, I losing my voice for no apparent reason.
Mm.
And it was only afterwards, when all this was over, really, I don't mean over, but when I was a lot further down the line, knowing that I was getting good results, them little things came back to me. And
you should have acted on them at the time.
It was a sign.
Yeah, you should have acted on them at the time. So you are working on one lung now.
Oh, yeah. I actually changed my name to a Chinese name now.
Oh.
They called me Mick One Lung.
Mick.
Right, what's that?
Karen One Lung. Karen, you've one lung as well.
I've one lung as well.
Listen to Mick, must be interesting to you, because you're a paediatric nurse and you specialise in oncology.
Yeah.
So when you were being told all about your own illness, did it make it easier or more difficult that you had the knowledge? You would have had more knowledge than Mick now, for example.
I'd have more knowledge than Mick, but I wouldn't have had any knowledge about lung cancer, because children don't get lung cancer.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I was quite ignorant about lung cancer to the extent that I didn't realise that I could have gotten lung cancer being a non-smoker.
Yes.
So when...
But the odds are stacked against you being a non-smoker.
As in?
As in the majority of people who get lung cancer are smokers. Is that it?
That has been the case.
Yes.
But increasingly people that don't smoke are getting lung cancer for some reason.
Right.
And I don't know proper statistics, but I know that in the next 20
years... Well, we'll talk to Dervla about that in a moment. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They predict that a lot more women who are non-smokers will get lung cancer.
Okay. What were your symptoms?
I didn't have any symptoms like Michael had. I had no lung symptoms at all. I didn't know I had any symptoms. In hindsight, I know I had symptoms. And the symptoms I know I had in hindsight were I had lost a little bit of weight, very marginal amount of weight, and I was really, really tired.
Okay.
I remember being in the canteen at work one day thinking, I'm sleeping more and yet I'm tireder every day. But I didn't realise at the time what that meant. And then what alerted me was I just was waking up at night time with a panic feeling that I had something wrong with my chest. And again, in hindsight, I had had in the December prior to my diagnosis, I was diagnosed in March. In the December prior to that, I had a very tiny little pain in my chest, like a pinpoint pain.
Right.
Which I now think must have been the tumour growing. But that was the December. And you're never going to think, if you have a little pain like that, the last thing you're going to think is, oh my God, there's a tumour growing inside.
Yeah.
But I used
but
to wake up...
But that's a scary thing as well, isn't it? That yes. It is growing inside you, unknowns to you.
Yes.
And the other, the positive thing is early detection leads to good outcomes.
Absolutely.
So if you get to stage 3 and 4, it becomes a lot more difficult.
Yes. So I was lucky. I was diagnosed at stage 1. And what alerted me, as I was telling you, was I used to wake up at night time just with a panicky feeling that there was something wrong with my chest. So I had nothing physical as such to go on. And this feeling went on.
But there must have been something happening there that woke you up in the first place, something physical before the mental thing. No.
There was nothing physical.
I don't understand that.
I was recognising.
Right, okay.
You were talking to the man, the undertaker, the other day, who said
David McGowan.
Very spiritual.
Yes. So you think it was a sign, do you?
Well, I have a little angel in heaven looking after me all the time. And I firmly believe that she was alerting
Who is your angel?
Our daughter, Rachel, who died 20 years ago now. She was 5 months old. And I just believe that she's with me all the time. And she was waking me at night time and telling me, you need to check this out. And around the same time, then I started getting a pain in my ribs on my left side. And not really a pain, just a discomfort. And that heightened my anxiety. And so I was looking for something. I felt I needed to go to the GP to get checked out. But it's very hard to go to the GP and say, I have a feeling that there's something wrong. And you don't have anything physical to
back it up.
So this feeling was going on and I was convinced that I had a lump in my ribs then. And I kept prodding at my ribs and feeling, oh, there's a lump there. So I got my husband to check and he said, no lump. So I thought, okay, this is all in your head. You have to forget about it. So then one particular morning, I was after dropping the kids to school, I was coming back and I said, God, if there's something wrong with me, will you send me a pain to tell so that I can go to the doctor with it? And the next day then when I was at work, I kept getting this kind of a stab in the ribs all the time. And so that was my pain. That was my reason to ring the doctor. So I rang the doctor and said, can I have an appointment? And I went into the doctor and luckily she listened to me. I didn't say to her, I think there's something wrong. I didn't know what I thought was wrong. But she listened to me and she gave me the time and she sent me for a chest x-ray.
And that's where they discovered it.
So I went into Nace General Hospital and they discovered the tumour on the x-ray. It was tiny, very small tumour. As I said, stage 1. So that's why I'm here 10 years later to tell the story.
Because a lot of people can't tell the story. We'll bring in Dervla now, Dr. Dervla Collins. She's in our Cork studio. How are you doing, Dervla? You've been listening there to Michael and to Karen. Is it Mick or Michael?
Well, you could call me anything.
Okay, right. So, Dervla, what are the outcomes when it comes to lung cancer?
Well, I suppose the outcomes are not very good on whole. I mean, lung cancer can present at many different stages. Generally, most people know early stage, which would be stage 1 or 2, and then later stages, which stage 3 and stage 4 is obviously when it's very advanced. I mean, the 5-year survivals in total are less than 20%. Yes. So only 1 in 5 actually gets to 5 years surviving after a diagnosis of lung cancer. The earlier you catch it, the better you have a chance of surviving. But even catching it at its very earliest stage, there's always that risk that these cancers can come back. But if the problem with this, and I think Michael and Karen have explained it really well, is these some of the symptoms that these cancers can cause are really subtle, and they're really hard to pinpoint, and they're not obvious, and it's a real silent killer in that only, you know, 20% of these cancers are picked up at Michael and Karen's stage.
And it's part of the problem that the symptoms can be confused with other things like, you know, a cold or a chest infection or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of 85% of these cancers are caused by smoking. So these patients often smoke. So they get these chest infections, recurrent chest infections, and they go in and out to their GP and get antibiotics, and they don't get the you know, the CT scans in order to diagnose them, because a lot of the time it is just infections. But these cancers are you know, obviously just silent, and they come on.
Yeah. And is there, as Karen says, or why is there an increase in lung cancer in people who don't smoke? Do we know?
So it's multifactorial. So it's a whole bunch of reasons why lung cancer in particular is increasing. So in women in particular, it's increasing. Now, some of that is because of smoking, and there's a lead in time, you see, from smoking to developing the lung cancer. It could be up to 20 years from your smoking exposure or the injury until you develop the lung cancer. So women really started, you know, smoking a lot more, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So we're seeing some of those cancers coming through now. But there is other reasons, environmental exposures. There's obviously the radon. There's obviously occupational hazards. And then there's just, you know, there might even be a genetic link. But a lot of the time it may just be, I suppose we call it bad luck. We just don't know why someone has developed a cancer. They don't have a reason that we can identify. And it comes down to sometimes a little bit of luck.
There are huge advances in the treatment of all types of cancer. What about lung cancer?
Yeah, I subspecialise in lung cancer, so it's a really it's a really good time to be involved in lung cancer. So, you know, if we look back 15 years ago, the 5-year survival for lung cancer was not even 10% probably. Whereas now we're starting to have much better treatments, drug like tablet treatments, but also this immunotherapy treatment where you can get a drip that actually gets your immune system to try and recognise the lung cancer and attack the lung cancer and get it under control. And we're starting to see, and while it doesn't work in everyone, and I suppose that's the key, it doesn't work in everyone, but if it does work, we're seeing some good responses, and we're seeing people with very advanced disease who are actually going into remission for much longer. So there's a lot of research, a lot of trials coming out in lung cancer, and there's a lot more options for our patients.
Mm. I see here that you deal with people maybe 4 times a week. You have to tell them that they have lung cancer.
Yeah, every clinic I have about 4 to 5 people a week, yeah.
That's a difficult thing to do, isn't it, to break that news to somebody?
Yeah, and it doesn't get easier.
Yeah. I imagine people react differently.
Yeah.
What's the most common reaction? Shock, is it, or...?
So by the time, so when they come to my clinic, they usually have a fair idea, like Michael kind of outlined. They've been told by their lung physician or that they have a tumour or they've got a cancer. So a lot of the time they already know they have a cancer, and the information I am giving them a lot of the time is about the future and what they need to expect moving forward, and I suppose a little bit about survival expectations, but also about treatment options.
Okay, Dr. Deborah Collins from the University Hospital Cork, thanks so much for coming into our Cork studio today. Michael and Karen, just before I let you go, what about the Mary Keaton Foundation? How did you encounter them, Michael?
I was involved with an aftercare group in Waterford called Solace. I got a bit of depression and anxiety and stuff after my treatment and all that, and I didn't know where to turn or where to go. And I will say they really put me back on the road down there, as regards I got a bit of counselling, we joined a men's group. We took on a little bit of a project when we were able. Some of us were able bodied, and some of us weren't. There's 14 to 15 lads in the group. we actually said we start a garden.
Right.
Down in the Sulla Centre, because they built onto a car park and they had some ground left over. There were some friends of ours that was up at Bloom. And
I think I met them up at Bloom.
You more than likely did.
Yeah.
You know, they'd make themselves known.
And how are you now? You're in your head and in your body. All good?
All very, very good,
okay.
Yeah.
And what about you, Karen?
The Mary Keating Foundation.
Yes, first and then...
So one of the nurse practitioners that looks after me in St. James has asked me, would I be interested in meeting with Jennifer from the Mary Keating Foundation to do some lung cancer awareness promotion. And I thought about it for a while and I thought, yes, I'd love to be involved in helping people to be aware of it and helping people to get diagnosed earlier. And I think the message I want to give is that if you do have any inkling that there's something wrong in your body, if you have subtle symptoms like tiredness, losing weight, and the cough, like Michael says, any symptoms at all like that, go straight to your
GP.
Get
it checked out.
And respond. And don't be afraid to go to the GP, because, like me, I was afraid to go because I had nothing to go with. But then when I did...
You had a sixth sense.
I had a sixth sense. And I went there. And thankfully now, 10 years later, I'm really, really well. I'm able to carry on a normal life.
We have to go, Michael.
Right.
I'll get in trouble if I don't go.
Right, Andrew.
Could you do it in 10 seconds?
Yeah. No, I just want to say these two companies, these two aftercare cup people, the Mary Keaton Foundation and the Solace Crowd and all the other ones are an essential part of getting back on the road.
Okay. Well, that's important to say. Karen, thanks for coming in. Michael, thank you. Safe home. Now we'll take a quick commercial break before Noakt.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Noakt 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Paula from Clonus, Benign, said, just listen in here. Our dad was diagnosed with lung cancer 2 years ago. We were told he'd have 3 to 6 months with us. Which was a massive shock. He didn't last 3 weeks. Bigger shock. He passed away with us all at home on New Year's Eve night, 2017, into the 1st of January 2018. We just had his anniversary mass last weekend, so it's really mad to hear this chat on the radio today. I hope people go and get checked out on time. Fair play to Michael. Sounds amazing, says Paula from Clonison. You have no idea of the shock of being told you have cancer. I was diagnosed 2 years ago. I had breast cancer and my world collapsed. But I'm a strong cookie. I miss my old self and I don't like always being in fear. And that's normal because most people never lose that fear. Patricia from Inchicore. And we just heard a bit of Michael's story about his anxiety and it's fear. It's brought on by fear of death, I suppose. And that's the thing that people don't talk about, waiting for the results of the test, the sleepless nights when you wake up and your first waking thought must be, you know, cancer. And that's very, very tough on top of the illness. Maybe people listening who do smoke could start to respect their friends and not smoke in their company, says Connie. And on posters, etc., posters were being put up in Gorey, Wexford, 2 hours after the election was announced. Cheers, says Ken Warren. And not all cable ties are left behind. I've been putting up and taking down posters for the last 20 years and always take cables and other parties' ones left behind. I think cable ties should be colour-coded so that people who don't take them away can be fined. There's an idea from Anne. And the M50 mad farmers on a go slow in their tractors. Be warned if you usually take the M50 to go somewhere at this time of the evening. And Kath says, just downloaded Colin McInerney's The River Holds Its Breath, which is his current album, and so wonderfully relaxing. And now the weather is the other one. What's the other one? I can't remember his first one, but I'll put the list of all his stuff up. We got a huge reaction to just that one tune we played at the top of the programme, which was called Late Afternoon. Now, last night, 9.30 RTE, if you tuned into episode 2 of Operation Transformation, you would have seen Tanya Carroll struggle with giving up Coca-Cola. Tanya's on the line now. How are you doing, Tanya?
Hi, Ray. I'm very good. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Yeah.
Good.
So just for people who don't know you, you were on 10 to 12 cans of Coke a day.
That's correct.
Which would be described as a habit, I suppose. And you were, I don't know if you were physically addicted, but you're definitely psychologically addicted.
Yeah, I suppose I was.
Yeah. Now, what did they say to you? Did they say that was the first thing you had to tackle on Operation Transformation?
Yeah, I had to get rid of the coke straight away, ASAP.
Okay, and when did you start? When did you when did you have your last can of Coca-Cola?
It was, say, last Sunday week, so about 10 days now I'm off the Coca-Cola.
We met you when we were in Glanmire last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And you were fine. I think things got worse for you, did they?
Yeah, it was, do you know what, it was the, I was agitated and I suppose the headaches and, I was kind of, I couldn't concentrate on things because I just kept thinking about having a nice can of Coke.
Yeah. So you're 10 days off. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you think this is it? Do you think you've cracked it?
Oh, there's no going back.
No.
No, definitely not. I can't for my own health's sake. You know, I was close to being a diabetic over it.
Yeah. And you told us last week that you were having your, the amount of sugar you should have in 2 weeks, you were having in 1 day.
Yeah, yeah.
From Coca-Cola. It's crazy. Yeah. And do you look back on that and go, how did I not know that?
Do you know what, now? I kind of knew that, you know, but I didn't know the amount.
Yeah, yeah.
That was in them. So it didn't really bother me, to be honest.
Okay. How are you today now, for example? Are the headaches gone?
Yeah, the headaches are gone. I'm just, you know, my body's just in shock to the whole, I suppose, the exercise and everything.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Are you delighted? You signed up for Operation Transformation?
Yes. I'm actually so proud of myself at the moment. You know, I thought I'd never be able to come off the coke and actually start losing weight. And yeah,
you're doing it. You're doing it. And you're having a lot of sport at home now, aren't you?
I have great support at home.
Yeah, your son Rean is doing the exercise with you.
Oh, sure. Rean's fantastic. They're all doing it, right? All the kids and Mark and everything. And without their support, I don't think I would be able to do it. It just makes everything that bit easier for me.
Yeah. It's
so everybody's eating the one meal.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not cooking different dinners for everyone. It's just they're on plan with me and it makes life that bit easier.
Okay. So you started off at 14 stone, 11 pounds and you were given, what was your target for the first week?
3 pounds.
And you lost 5, so well done.
Yeah.
And what's your target for next week?
3 pounds again.
Great. So I think that should be no problem to you.
Hopefully.
Terry and Listowel-Varna wants to know, with that consumption of Coca-Cola, could you ask Tanya how are her teeth?
I was at the dentist 6 months ago and they were fine.
Okay.
I just needed to get them cleaned. But I was told during the week by a lady that once I give up the coke that my gums might come at me. So,
right.
I don't know, it hasn't happened yet, but my teeth are fine. They're not discoloured, like they're not black or anything.
Okay. Well done. We'll talk to you before the end of the run. Keep it going.
Brilliant.
See you, Tanya.
Quick question.
Oh, yeah,
can you say hello to Glentown Care Home, all the residents?
Oh, yes, I saw
it.
Yes. Now, just say it again.
Just say hello to all the residents in Glentown Care Home.
Glentown Care Home. Okay.
Yeah.
Hello to all the residents of Glentown Care Home. And I know that Tanya loves you all and she's doing a brilliant job there, as are the rest of the staff. How's that?
Thanks, Melina.
Okay, Tanya, good talking
to you.
Bye now. Bye.
Operation Transformation on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Safe Food. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we're joined in studio by child and adolescent psychotherapist Coleman Nochter. How are you doing, Coleman? Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Ray.
And all that. I said that I'd put this to you, and actually, we've two that are similar, so I'll put both of them to you at the same time. That one from earlier on, from Fiona. How much detail is too much for our teens about that poor 17-year-old who lost his life recently and was dismembered? I feel like walking my teens into a funeral home and pointing out the consequences of taking or getting involved with drugs. Should we scare the bejesus out of them? That's one question. And this is related, so you can take them two separately or together. I wonder if Coleman Nochter offers some advice for my 12.5-year-old son. He currently has feelings of guilt and anxiety about news stories, etc., pain in his tummy, going off food, etc. We have worry time and he talks and has a little cry and usually feels a bit better, but that doesn't really help with the appetite and tummy pain. So they're related but different. So let's deal with the, you know, should we scare the bejesus out of children when it comes to drugs and getting involved?
Okay. There's, you have a choice here about doing what is right and what's effective. And sometimes they can be different things.
Right.
Okay. Ooh. So from the point of view of how do you approach something like drug use and do it in a PC way without being quite forthright about it? Do you know what I mean? If the outcome is your child is terrified of taking drugs, that's a pretty good outcome. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view, but it's not how you should do it, because we are motivated by fear and desire. So obviously fear is a motivator. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to get in crime. And that's a reasonable motivator. But you want someone to be motivated by desire. I want to do the right thing. Right. Yeah. So depending on the child and the leanings of the child who generally chooses to do the right thing, then I'd go with desire. But a child who's a bit, you know,
wayward,
tempted by the wilder side, experimental, a little bit of that, a little bit of fear is no harm, you know what I mean, from the point of view. Now, how much is too much? Look, with the stories around graphic images and everything else going around at the moment, that's too much. And, you know, we have a fascination with violence as a culture, every one of us. You know, there's a famous article about if it bleeds, it leads. So the media will always go to the gory side of stuff. And that just feeds our fascination, our fear and our fascination with violence. And if we don't share that stuff around, it'll stop. Do you know what I mean? But it's the our fascination with it that keeps that going. Yes. Right? So that's too much. But telling someone that getting into that world has its own dangers and costs, it's not about glitz and glamour and driving a Range Rover at 21 years of age. It's about the risk of being caught and the consequence of that. Whether you have to take them to a funeral parlour, I think is a step too far. Okay. But again, a little bit of fear is okay, but depending on the child.
But that's interesting. So it's bespoke nearly, depending on the personality
Absolutely.
Of the child.
And then that leads us on to the second lad here, who's kind of taken by most of the stories in the news and is kind of getting very sensitive
about it. Take them on board.
Yeah. Now, the mum has said he's a softie, right? I have an issue with soft. I think if we replace soft with deep, this is the difference, right? Soft is a weakness, right? Deep is actually a strength from that point of view. And this is a temperament issue. I see loads of children like this. So he's 12 and a half. He's getting affected by everything. He's worried about climate change. He's worried about the planet. He's worried about everything that he's hearing. And we have a very fear-driven media. So, you know, everything's okay, but it might not last that way. And, you know, everything's built that way. So to see children getting into that. But his depth is a gift in terms of he will be a ferocious friend. You know what I mean? He'll be a lad who come collect you at 4 a.m. when you run out of petrol. He's that type of kid. But at the moment, that gift is being a challenge because he's taking on far too much. The somatic complaints going off the food. What he needs, he's seeking a feeling of safety. And reassurance isn't always safety. Saying it'll be grand doesn't really work all the time, or it's nowhere near here. What you need to introduce is three things: context, perspective, and reality. Okay. There are bad people in the world. Bad things happen, but there's a lot more good. And it's about trying to get the balance of that so the child focuses on the good parts of life and humanity as well as the dark, because he's focusing on the dark.
Because he knows there is bad out there because he's seen it on the telly.
Yeah, and he's probably bright. He probably reads papers. He's probably that kid who you're trying to...
So you need to let him own that, but then put it in perspective.
Yeah, he has all the intellect and the emotional depth that he needs, but he doesn't have the life experience or the cognitive ability to understand it. Right. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
so he has all the exposure without the life experience, and you have to almost pre-introduce him to that at a level of context, perspective, and reality. They're the three things that we all turn to when we're starting to panic.
Context, perspective and reality. Okay, that's great advice. Now, I'm looking for some advice on how to help my 4.5-year-old son. I understand that he may be going through a testosterone surge at this age. However, his behaviour can be very bad at times. He's hitting and kicking us when he doesn't get his own way. He's very willful and stubborn. He doesn't listen and is not doing what he's told. And it's a battle to get him to do anything, be it get dressed, eat his dinner, get out for a walk or whatever. I know this can be typical for a child of his age. However, it is very frustrating. Prior to bedtime, he gets a burst of energy and it can take him up to 2.5 hours to fall asleep, always with one of us in bed with him. We try to get him out and about as much as possible and run the legs off him. However, this is not always the case. He is an only child and will be starting school this September when I'm told his behaviour will improve. I want to know if this is just a phase or if there's anything we can do to improve the situation. He gets lots of love and playtime from both me and his father.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to rule out the testosterone surge. I don't think it's that. Right.
Does that exist?
Not in my view. No. Right, okay. I mean, he's 4.5. Yeah. He's challenging and he's a boisterous boy. You know, not to gender specific people, but, you know, he's energetic. And he's using the approach that's always been effective for him. which is if you act out, you probably get what you want. And as unpopular as that might be, that's what has to change. He has to not get any rewards from his misbehaviour. Running the legs off him is an energy issue. It's not a behavioural issue. So he may be too tired to misbehave, but you're not actually dealing with the misbehaviour issue. School may well help, but I would be trying to help him now before he gets there, because it's a laboratory of life. It can be the school of hard knocks if you're a kid who doesn't get the whole idea of turn taking or waiting for your turn, that sort of stuff. He needs containment, he needs structure, he needs to not reward the misbehaviour. And if that means disattending to him, he's an only child, so it might be difficult because he may be used to a lot of time in that sense. But it's an attention economy. He's looking for attention, he's looking for reward. Mm. If he knows that being this way gets what I want, you have to change that. And that's it's an easy, simple idea, but difficult to do.
You know, animals know that if a certain behaviour gets reward, they continue to do it. That's it. It's hardwired into us, isn't it?
Yeah, and like animals. If it's working, why would you not keep using it? Do you know, even from the point of view? So if the issue is to change that association between misbehaviour, acting out, and get out of want, reinstating the rules of what's allowed and what's not allowed. He might have a skewed idea of that, but try reward good behaviour. So when he does manage to do something or take a no or manage that, so he's getting the attention on the bits that he's managing. Catch him being good, almost. But this may not be a problem that's just started. It may be something that he has developed a belief over time. And that's what means, yes, it is a phase, but it's a phase that won't change unless your environment does a little
and
bit.
And you did say at the start that it will be difficult at the start.
Of course it is, yeah. You're starting a new culture. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And he has to learn that. And he has already hardwired beliefs around what he does get certain things, and he has to rewire that a little bit.
Okay, good luck with that. Dear Coleman, I have a 17-year-old boy in fifth year at school with loads of ability. The subjects he likes, he scores well in, but he scored dismally in those he doesn't. He doesn't have a great work ethic at school and simply doesn't care. What can I do to encourage him to work at his schoolwork? We have tried everything, taking his phone, etc. Any tips would be appreciated. Thanks.
Yeah, we get this one. This again, I can't say this enough times. You can't make a child study. You just can't. Like, you can take everything off them, but it is a self-determined activity. You know what I mean?
Well, particularly when you get to 17.
Yeah, I mean, some would say the horse is bolted at this point, but I would say you have to entice him to try and do it. And I know that sounds contraindicated. You want to be kind of corralling him into doing it, but it won't work. Enticing him by trying to sell the positives. And again, I would explore if there's something going on. If he's a lad who has ability, he may, and I see this so many times, Ray, this is a really popular thing for 17-year-old boys. It's a fear of failure. Uh-huh. Right? So if I try and I don't do well, I've exposed myself that's the limit of my ability.
I don't think it's exclusive to 17-year-old boys.
No. But the issue
I know a lot of adults.
Like, it's the kind of case of if I don't put in any effort and I get mediocre results, well, then people say I'm a misunderstood hero. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And my mother used to always say, Coleman could do anything, only he's lazy. And I was there going, well, there's no way I'm not being lazy, because as soon as I start work, I'm going to be exposed for what I can't do. Does that make sense?
Yes, no, it does.
And
it does,
so
completely.
Removing the kind of expectation idea may indeed help him to engage a little bit more. He may not be doing it because he doesn't want to do it. He may be doing it because he's a little bit of a fear of it. One quick study tip, if somebody likes studying the stuff that they like doing and doesn't study the other, list your subjects from 1 to 7, your favourite to your least favourite. The first night, do 1 and 7. The second, do 6 and 2. The next, do the...
Yes.
And making it just makes sure that you're covering everything.
That's a good tip.
As part of your study plan, because we all like to do the bits we're good at,
and
we leave the last bits to the end. So
okay,
it's just a
right. Have we got time for this? Because we have a statement from the Green Party. We'll do this very quickly. I recently got divorced, and all through the separation, my kid's dad had steadily got more unreliable and unsupportive in raising his children. He can't hold down a job, moves apartments a lot, and promises the kids a lot of things that don't happen. He doesn't pay maintenance and hasn't a car right now. They love their dad, and I encourage them to see him, but they're getting older now and more aware. They're starting to ask a lot of questions. I'm torn as to what to tell the children. How honest should I be with them? They're 9 and 11.
Yeah, the sentence there, I encourage them to see him, is mom wants them to see him for what he is. And maybe they're 9 and 11, so they'll start to do that. Rather than, I think, focusing on what you believe dad deserves, try and focus on what you believe your kids need at this point. You know, if your dad's unreliable, that'll come to the surface. They'll realise that over time. There's no need to preempt that. If they're still in a kind of a fantasy that dad's a good person, and even if dad is a bit all over the place, which he sounds to be, that's okay. They'll find that in time.
Difficult for her, though.
It is a real challenge. I mean, you have to giving somebody what they need rather than what they deserve is oftentimes the hardest thing in the world. But it's something. It's a useful piece of advice, and it's like that 17-year-old who studies. Don't give him what he deserves. Give him what he needs.
Okay. Good. Coleman, good advice as always. And Coleman will be back with us in a few weeks' time. Coleman Ogden, thank you very much. And the Green Party have a statement on their postering. As a party, we support a change to designated postering areas that are managed by local authorities and administered in an equitable way. This system is in place in lots of European countries. Unfortunately, however, the current system remains in place and many of our candidates will be forced to poster because it has been shown that it puts candidates at a serious disadvantage, especially new candidates. We are the only party who have made any effort to change the system to something more equitable and less wasteful. And that's a statement from the Green Party on their postering policy. That's it from us. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Mary Wilson is on the way. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.